and welcome to the last programme in this series of Life Before Vinyl on Resonance 104.4 FM. This is Adrian Tudnam, and I'm going to be your guide for the next half hour as we ramble through a miscellany of sounds from the forgotten past. Several times in this series, we've begun the programme with music by Paul Godwin's orchestra, and I make no apology for doing it one more time. This is one of those records that just has to be heard to be believed. It's called The Frog Parade. See what you make of it. That was The Frog Parade by Creutzfeldt and Huygens, recorded in 1928 by Orlando and his orchestra. In the record trade, the vast majority of issues were legitimate and moral by the standards of their day, even if some of the business practices of the trade were not. Just occasionally a record was published which would not have met with universal approval, particularly by those who wished to uphold conventional ideas of morality. These records were sold discreetly, probably being kept under the counter rather than on public display. By the late 1930s, Ronald Franco was making a name for himself with slightly dubious lyrics, but his innuendo was tame compared with the next record I'm going to play. It's called The Wedding of the Gigolo and is sung by Stuart Ross and Joe Sargent. I wonder how they got away with it.
Listen, everybody, gather round me while I tell my tale. The news is spreading all about the wedding, the marriage of a most important male. draw your chairs quite near, while I make things clear. 'Twas a very jolly frolic, all the drinks were alcoholic, yes, indeed, a very grand affair. Every mistress in the land was there. 'Twas the wedding of the gigolo. All his past and present mamas brought him gifts of old pajamas and the sweetest things in crepe de chine, in the very palest tangerine, for the wedding of the gigolo. In an hour the men were plastered, the women just the same. They shrieked at the host, "You're a love child," and they called the bride a filthy name. He so gallantly cavorted with the dames he'd once escorted, as they danced they whispered in his ear, "You will still have time for us, my dear, even though you're married gigolo." Brunettes and redheads and moth-eaten blondes rushed up with their presents of 6% bonds. Tailors who dressed him with consummate pride dashed in and presented their bills to the bride. Sweet-scented flowers lined all the four walls. Young men of both sexes who answer all calls. The mayor was angry, and loudly he said, "You know it's not natural for gigolos to wed." Then came a noise, a terrible din, and holding a gun, the bride's father walked in. He said, "Don't be frightened, come on, what the hell? I'm just here to see all is done right by my Nell." Now the storytellers tell us every lady there was jealous. Don't you know why they were so upset? The bride was getting what they tried to get by a marriage to a gigolo. In their efforts to be sexy, five had fits of apoplexy, and one girl committed suicide, while another tried to shoot the bride at the wedding of the gigolo. Every dowager over 40 just yearned for one more fling. They shouted, "It's not very sporty," when the time came for retiring. When they'd climbed the golden stairs, the bride knelt down to say her prayers. "Now I lay me down to sleep." And there the gigolo cried out, "Oh yeah, 'twas the wedding of the gigolo."
The Wedding of the Gigolo, sung by Stuart Ross and Joe Sargent in 1930. You're listening to Life Before Vinyl on Resonance 104.4 FM. Much more popular than the under-the-counter stuff were records of hymn tunes and religious music. In these days, when fewer and fewer people attend church, it comes as a surprise to find how large a part church-going played in people's lives a few generations back. People who could not attend church because of infirmity, or those who particularly enjoyed hymn singing, would often put a hymn tune on the gramophone and sing along with it. The next record is not actually a hymn, but a Christmas carol. It Came Upon a Midnight Clear. I've chosen this particular version because of the unusual tune. In England, the most popular tune for these words is adapted from one called Noel, written by Sir Arthur Sullivan. But this record uses the American tune Carol, which was written by Richard Storrs Willis. was It Came Upon a Midnight Clear, sung by the Oratorio Choir to the American tune Carol. Whilst we're on matters spiritual, this seems like a good time to listen to a record which occasionally turns up in the miscellaneous category at record fairs. As far as I know, it's the only commercial pre-war recording of a spiritualist séance. The medium is Mrs. Moirig Morris, and on this part of the record she speaks in a voice which is quite unlike her own, which she claims belongs to a spirit named Power.
Children, this great truth of communion and the knowledge of the Bible has given to your religion not only a blind faith, but a fact. Not only a belief, but a knowledge that man himself is a spiritual being. That at so-called death, he discards the terrestrial garment and therefore soars into another world of existence. But the key that opens out the wider beauty of that world is dependent upon the man, the true man himself. That is, through his character, that by thought, word, and deed, he shall be known. And because of that finer body, he shall dwell in that sphere of life, understanding more and more of the great knowledge of that creative power.
Mrs. Moirig Morris in a trance. This particular record has an additional point of interest. The centre of the disc bears the signature of the Reverend John Lamond, who renounced his position in the Church of Scotland to become a leading spiritualist. He signed the master wax to confirm that he was a witness at the séance and no trickery was involved. You're listening to Life Before Vinyl on Resonance 104.4 FM. One of the unsung heroes in the development of electrical recording during the 1920s was a young inventor named P.G.A.H. Voigt. He was employed by the Edison Bell Company as their wireless expert and single-handedly developed an entire electrical recording system which rivaled that of the international recording giants. They were funded with massive budgets from the American film and record industries and had top radio laboratories and experts at their disposal. In contrast, Paul Voigt beavered away in a back street in Peckham, making his own test equipment and discovering the ground rules for himself. His task couldn't have been made any easier by having a boss like J.E. Huff, who didn't hold with such newfangled nonsense as electrical recording. He used to make scathing remarks to Voigt about how terrible these electrical records sounded on a clockwork gramophone in his office, and that would be the way his customers would probably hear them. Despite many setbacks, Voigt held his own against the giants of the industry, even getting HMV to eventually admit that they had a fault in the design of their microphones. He later went on to develop his own loudspeaker, a design which was eventually taken over by Lowther and is still around today. Despite his immense fund of knowledge and the significant but unrecognised contributions he made to the recording industry, he was still an enthusiastic amateur at heart. In the 1940s, he spent a lot of his spare time encouraging experimenters and giving talks to local radio clubs in the South London area. Here is one of Voigt's electrical recordings from 1928, and despite the homemade equipment he was using, his microphones were constructed from ebonite rods and gold-plated condoms, the sound quality is pretty good. Thank you. That was Jean Pack, the Belgian ragtime pianist, playing Flapperette on an Edison Bell radio recording from 1928. It's rare to find a national disaster commemorated by a record, but the unashamedly heart-rending song on the next record was intended to stir the public conscience and raise funds for the families of the victims. I don't need to tell you any more about it. It speaks for itself.
Dedicated to the memory of the greatest shipping disaster in the history of the world, the loss of the world's Leviathan, the Titanic, of 45,000 tons, 46,000 horsepower, by collision with an iceberg in mid-Atlantic when on her maiden voyage on the 14th of April 1912, and to that of the 1,635 passengers and crew who perished in the icy sea. Also in proud remembrance of the heroes who sacrificed their lives for others in obedience to the instinct of their race and the grand old captain's exhortation, "Be British! Hats off, sleeves!" When the mighty ship Titanic started from Southampton Bay, there were cheers and fond goodbyes too as she proudly steamed away. But soon a last disaster came and filled all hearts with woe. Although in sorrow now we weep, we yet are proud to know every man at his post as the big ship went down to save precious lives. There we find them. They died like heroes true. Now something we must do for the wives and little ones they left behind them. In the darkness of the night there came a crash, the crash of a doom, and the gallant crew soon realized the sea must be their tomb. The order came to lower the boat, and one thing had to be: the women and the children first, for that's the way at sea. Every man at his post as the big ship went down to save precious lives. There we find them. They died like heroes true. Now something we must do for the wives and little ones they left behind them.
Well, we've come to the end of the programme and the end of the series. I hope you've enjoyed listening to the records as much as I have, and that, like me, you now feel you've gained a better idea of what life was like before vinyl. To end the programme, I'm going to play the signature tune, which you've only heard for a few seconds each week, right through from beginning to end. So this is Adrian Tuddenham, thanking you for your company, wishing you well, and leaving you with Caravan, played by the Bohemian Band.